So the talk for tonight is entitled, The Heart of Right View. So what is the heart of right view? What is right view? Why should we have it? What is the heart component of that? So I'll talk about that in a wide range of ways this evening. But first of all, I want to congratulate you all on your making it and surviving it through the first day. I've had many first day of retreats, and they're challenging, I find. Sleepiness, tiredness, lots of different things come up. And you probably don't realize it. We realize it because we're not as focused and concentrated as you are. You guys are pretty focused. You're probably going, no, I'm not. I'm all over the place. But you're totally not. You really developed a lot of concentration, a lot of focus, a lot of body awareness, and a lot of things that are happening for you probably you don't really necessarily realize. So good for you. So when we look at practice, we look at the Dharma, the teachings, what the Buddha's suggestion was for us, it actually encompasses a lot more than just practicing meditation. So some of you are probably familiar with the teaching or the structure of the Eightfold Path. And so that was the Buddha's suggestion, was for us as human beings, if we have found that life has been difficult or challenging and maybe we're confused about what to do, where to go, his suggestion would be to cultivate the Eightfold Path, which is eight things that leads us in a direction of being liberated or having an appropriate amount of happiness. And meditation is one of those. Meditation practices encompass three components of the Eightfold Path, the teachings of right effort, which I'm sure you've noticed, having the appropriate amount of effort for the practice varies greatly from moment to moment, doesn't it? Effort, mindfulness, and concentration. So a lot of what you're working with in your practice every day, whether you recognize it or not as you sit here, is trying to balance effort with concentration, bringing the right amount of effort to concentration, not too much effort, right? But not too sloppy effort. And if you can kind of get the effort and the concentration, you know, good enough, then the mindfulness is really quite good. You're very aware of what's happening, able to recognize what's happening, hopefully becoming able to be accepting and friendly towards what's happening. And that really gets our system at ease and allows us to become more clear about what to do with this life. So right view is all about working with our perception. And we know that perception is one of the components that makes up the mind, and that perception changes constantly. And that perception, much of the time, is very inaccurate, very limited. We're not always seeing the whole picture. We're cutting out a very, very tiny aspect of our experience, and we're kind of making a worldview based on whatever is happening right now. And the thing that makes it so challenging is perception in some areas of our life is very valuable. Depth perception. Everybody drove here in a car and probably didn't hit anybody or a tree or anything like that. So when it comes to guiding ourselves through physics, depth perception, being able to walk and use a fork, perception, our perceptual mechanisms are really good as human beings. We have really great motor neurons, which is how we learn to talk and how we learn to move, and those parts of our system are very fine-tuned and work very well. But the perception around self and the world, our perception around those kinds of things, perceptions around emotion, what we think somebody means by what they say, by the look that they just gave us. We really miss that one a lot. Our perception is very, very inaccurate. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the role of mindfulness, this word sati, to remember to recognize, this ability to remember to recognize, and also part of sati and mindfulness, which nobody talks about, interestingly enough, is about learning. What are you learning? You know, how many times do you have to put your hand on the stove before you learn to not touch it? Maybe once. How many times today did you have to learn that getting obsessed and caught in the past or the future doesn't work? How many times did you hit that stove? We just have such a hard time with that. It's amazing to me that the mind can learn one thing one time and just know, okay, don't do that. And we'll never do it again. And then when we start to deal with our present time psychology, emotional experience, subjective reality, we find that we take the same bait over and over and over again because we misperceive that. We don't see it clearly. So this term sati, remembering to recognize what's the hot stove, what's not the hot stove, and learning, continuously learning to redirect yourself back to that basic aspect of paying attention to the breath of the body, to come back to right now, to the mansions of fear and loss and worry and anticipation and regret are all just concepts in the mind. They're all just perceptions about some experience other than the one that you're actually having. So the mind is very hypnotizing, isn't it? And so we find that we, as we try to wake up, which is what the practice is about, awakening, the Buddha teaches a path of awakening. That's what Buddha means. Buddha means to be awake. Wake up. We could very easily translate Buddhism, and we probably should translate it to wake up-ism. Wake up. Pay attention. What's going on? But what happens, truthfully, and probably obviously, if you wake up and fall asleep and wake up and fall asleep 400,000 times a day. Right. And there's this theory in the Abhidharma and the Buddhist psychology that's also been talking about in modern neuroscience now around the cultivation of awareness, is that short moments repeated become continuous. Short moments repeated become continuous. So we have these little flickering, maybe perhaps tiny, short little episodes of awakening. We come back, we're stable, we're here, we're present, we're at ease, we're awake, and then we fall asleep. But that little tiny, you know, half a second, 3 seconds, 4 breaths, over time, short moments repeated become continuous, starts to become longer and longer and longer. And the longer and longer they become, the more we start to live an awakened life. And the moments that we're awake are much longer than the moments that we're asleep for. And then we find, of course, over time, we continually modulate between those two. And this, I think, is something that we don't always, I know that I don't always, I shouldn't say that. I mean, what I'm trying to say is I often take that for granted. For me, growing up, I had, I have what I call very good Dharma karma. Is I've had very, very, I've been very lucky and very blessed, I should say, in my relationship to Dharma and the Dharma teachers I've had and the Dharma transmissions that I've had. I've had some big, epic, sort of iconic moments around the practice that really had pretty radical and profound changes for me. And really the big one is the one that we talk about here constantly. When I was 19 years old, I had been through, I had barely sort of made it through my teen years and had a lot of loss in my early life, and I had a lot of traumatic events go down, and I didn't really have any friends. I had lots of acquaintances. I was already pretty much well on my way to being a drug addict and an alcoholic. I was very, very dissatisfied with the world. I was very, very unhappy with life, and I couldn't even grasp or consider that there would ever be anything about living in this world that would be anything except for misery. At the age of 19, that's a fairly heavy burden to carry. And I was very lucky that I had some friends, or a friend whose parents were involved with some of the teachers at the Insight Meditation Society. And I had gotten very close with my friend's mom. And I think she could tell that there was something going on with me that wasn't not great. And really wanted to help me. And I really trusted her. I was also, at that age, extremely suspicious and had a tremendous amount of contempt for adults and authority. So listening to a teacher or a parent or adult or any adult authority figure was something that I simply was not going to do. But something about my friend's mom was very trustworthy. You know, she had a deep Dharma practice, it turned out. She was very kind. She was very understanding. And she brought me to meet my first teacher, Stephen Smith, who I met him when I was 19. I met him in the morning. I talked to him about my life and some of the things that I had been through, how angry and confused and upset I was. And also was like, I don't know why I'm telling you this. Like, I don't even know who you are. Like, why am I talking to you about this thing? And he talked about, yeah, he offered me some perspective, which I'll get into a little bit more, about understanding life in a much deeper way. Really what he did is he normalized suffering for me. He's like, yeah, you're suffering, and that happens to people. And your reaction to that is actually quite appropriate, to be angry, to be confused, to be upset. That's very appropriate response to what you've been through. And there's something you can actually do about it. And that was when I learned mindfulness practice. And I learned what I taught you this morning, which probably most of you have already learned before, is that I could take my attention out of my thinking mind, and I could put it on my breath for 1 or 2 seconds, and all of the stories, all of the delusion, all of the fear, all of the anger, all of the reliving of the stories, the planning of the revenges, all of that suffering was actually inside my mind. None of it was happening. It wasn't happening to me 98% of the time. But I couldn't. That type of suffering, the loss, the fear, it was actually my view, it was my worldview. I actually took all of that suffering as if it was a pair of glasses that I viewed the world through. Pain and loss and despair and distrust. That was my view of the world. The world is like this. And then when I learned that I could remove myself from that view and hear birds and feel the breath, that I was like, oh, there's actually something else. There's something else that's actually happening. Right? That actually, since that day, really, like, I got up off the cushion. I have never had an experience that was as such a radical shift for me as that was. In fact, I like to jokingly say I've been chasing it for like 24 years. And sometimes in Zen practice, they call that sudden awakening followed by a gradual cultivation. And I think the practice is actually like that. We have these sudden awakenings, and you've all had them, right? You've had experiences in your life, and some of them are tragic and traumatic. Some of them not at all. Some of them are beautiful. There's a wide range of experiences that wake us up. But we've had those sometimes called aha moments. We're like, wait a minute, I'm totally seeing this all wrong. Oh, I was wrong about that. Oh, it's like this. Oh, there's some possibilities here. And all of a sudden, that opens us up into a view, into a perspective that's different than it once was. And once you wake up to that, it's actually kind of hard to fall asleep back into the old paradigm. And so you have these, you have this little awakening shift, and it starts to steer you in a different kind of direction. And so this is starting to allow us to let our perception and our attitude and our worldview and our self-view open up a little bit, and to develop this right view, which is problematic in the sense that there's a right view, so that means there's a wrong view. And so I want to speak a little bit about that terminology because I think it's important. Many of you who are familiar with the Eightfold Path know that each path factor starts with the word right. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood. And that's a little black and white. That's not so helpful. And this word samaditti, which is what right view means, it means samaditti, it means to see accurately, to understand things accurately, to see clearly, to have that wisdom we talk about, to be able to understand the nature of things, how things really are here. But that's not it, that's half. And the other half is to see empathetically, to see with conscious and concern, to see the interdependence of all this suffering. I suffer, you suffer. It's not just happening to me. Everybody's struggling with something. Everybody has some internal experience that they are struggling with. Then that interdependence, that sense of this is part of my humanity, actually, really takes the selfishness out of it. You know, this huge movement right now, me too. Oh, you too? Oh yeah, me too. Oh, that happened to me too. And this is really what rallies people together. There's this little rhyme that I used when I was teaching emotional intelligence with teenagers. We would say empathy means just like me. Oh, you too? Oh, just like me? Oh, I had that experience too. Oh, that was really hard. Oh yeah, me too. And it creates connection, it creates empathy, and it allows us to not be so isolated and trapped into our own subjective experience. Everybody else is totally happy. Everybody in the world is doing great but me. Right? You know this experience? Yeah. So samaditti, sama actually means complete. Complete view. Are you seeing the complete picture? And that's why mindfulness and awareness is really trying to get us to open up to the full range of the phenomenological world, the body, the breath, all of the sense doors, breathing, hearing, walking. Because we have a really hard time seeing the whole complete picture. We're seeing what we're paying attention to, and we're getting this limited window into experience, and we see this little tiny view about how it is right now, and we take that little tiny view and we put that lens on, and that becomes our worldview. So actually in every single moment of experience you are seeing things in a particular way. They're affecting how you feel, they're affecting how you behave. And we see things incorrectly. We get caught in all these polarized views, self and other, right and wrong, good and bad, good and evil. We don't understand how complex things are, how interdependent our relational field with others is. And we have to train ourselves to see that. And so part of right view, or I like to think about the complete picture, There's a lot of different ways to work with it. And part of it is sort of the educational part of like just conceptually trying to understand some of these ideas. I find it very fascinating that actually most of what the early Buddhist tradition offers, none of it's really that complicated to actually understand conceptually. A lot of it is just like, yeah, this all makes pretty good sense. But it's the application of some of these things that we find to be much more challenging. And so when we start to work in the practice, we start to work in these kind of three ways of we understand something conceptually and go, oh, gee, that kind of makes sense. So I think maybe I'll give that a try. That sounds about right. And that's what gets you on a retreat like this. Like, you think you came on this retreat? You didn't come on this retreat. Wisdom came on this retreat. Wisdom said, you should do this thing. This would be good. Got you here. Something about your experience in life already, whatever accumulative wisdom you had, got you here. You didn't get here. So we're up against this in every single moment. We see these very limited experiences. And so we take that idea and then we actually give it a shot. So we try to apply it, which is what you've been doing all day. The mental cultivation. And then based on what you learned in sort of your own little laboratory of direct subjective experience, then you deduce or choose which things that you've learned, there's that word again, learned, about mindfulness, about your experience, you choose to continue with those or not. And that view, that perspective, allows you to actually change everything about probably how you live and how you think and how you feel. You wake up. I don't know about you, but for me, these are insanely encouraging ideas. Very attractive ideas to my mind. So we have to be careful that we don't get in this little tiny view of like, okay, I don't connect the dots here. Why is sitting here quietly with my eyes closed watching my breath? How is this actually going to help me? Like, I got some real problems. I got some stuff going on in my life. This is not going to be the solution. And then the doubt, and then the fear, and then the becoming disintegrated happens. One of the things that I also think is important to acknowledge about perception and view and experience, we could even say experience, what are the building blocks of human experience, is looking at really what was the, I like to look at the history and the worldview. Who is this Buddha person, this Siddhartha Gautama, who we credit all of these teachings to? What was his perception? What was his worldview? What was the time and place that he grew up in? What was his dilemma? What motivated him to develop these kinds of practices? And interestingly enough, it, at that time and place, 25, 26, 2800 years ago in ancient India, they didn't have the kind of worldview that we had, like as if like I'm a person living in the world and the world is out there. There's an out there world and I'm a person who's in this out there world and how can I make the best of this world? So we're very kind of conditioned to be in this idea of there's an out there, and if I can get all the things out there just how I like them, if I can get the right job, the right relationship, the right car, the right amount of money in the bank, the right this, the right that, the right everything, then I would feel happy and I would be content and my life would have meaning and purpose. And so that's kind of like what we do, right? I don't know where you grew up, but that's that kind of how that works. But they didn't have that worldview. They were very interested in how the mind creates the world. They didn't really actually subscribe to this line of thinking that there was an out there. They're very internally focused in the sense of that the world is created through the mind and body. And the Buddha took it one step further, where they did a lot of practices to try to transcend that in almost a religious sense of doing these deep concentration practice to transcend that, to be like sort of one with the universe kind of ideas. Very esoteric. If the Buddha tried those practices, he's very very dissatisfied with those kinds of practices. And he kept coming back to this question that we hear about constantly in his teachings on the Four Noble Truths, that he was very confronted by the idea of birth, old age, sickness, and death. So he realized he was a person in the world who was going, this is going to end. And there doesn't seem to be much one can do about that. This is going to end. What is this for? What am I supposed to be doing with this? And probably most importantly, I think what he recognized is that not only he himself, but he also recognized in other people that we suffer in ways that seem to be very unnecessary. We suffer about things that aren't actually happening right now. The great Mark Twain quote, "Some of the worst days of my life never happened." No. And so he was very interested in that. Like this, it's all this internal mental anguish, craving, and there's a lot of suffering that seems to just be in here, actually. It has nothing to do with any of this. What can you do about that? Can you do something about that? And so the Dharma, his practices, his path, his ideas, are all for the sole purpose of that endeavor. To understand suffering and understand the end of suffering. And we see this. So it's like almost like you sit down and close your eyes and it's just like, boom, there it is. This should be happening. This should be happening. Why is this happening? Why are they doing this? Just all this like arguing with reality. There's a 17th century French philosopher named Blaise Pascal who has a lot of interesting quotes. And one of my favorite quotes is, he said, "All human misery stems from the fact that we can't sit quietly in a room by ourselves." Turns out to be pretty hard. Can you sit quietly in a room by yourself? Do you appreciate the company that you keep in the privacy of your own mind? Sometimes. Not all the time. So again, part of this perspective, this view is about seeing more clearly, more accurately, being more aware of and informed by the limitations of the human experience. But probably as important, if not maybe a little bit more important, is how do we bring a sense of empathy and compassion and concern towards the struggle that we go through. So the Dharma is not, it's not about being smart or being clever or being intellectually understanding these sometimes intriguing and even at times esoteric concepts. It's not about getting it. That might be enough to prompt some application of it. But in and of itself, this is not an intellectual endeavor. And people fall into that trap quite easily, myself included. "I just got to figure out what the Buddha meant and I'll be fine." No, dude. That's not going to cut it. So it kind of, we can get prompted by this at times in our lives and probably at many times in our lives. I know that for me, historically, I've had these periods of time, I've had maybe a handful of what I call these little existential crises, which I love at existential crisis because it means something good's about to happen, typically for me, where I'm just, there's a rub, there's something that I'm not sure why I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm frustrated. And a lot of the times it has to do with the fact that I'm clinging to the world in a way that's destructive and that's unrealistic. If I can just make this job work out, I just got to make this job work out. I got to make it work out. I got to make this relationship work. I just got to get X amount of dollars. You know, I just live in the wrong city. I just need to move. I just need to get that degree. I just need to move to the country and forget about it all. Do you have any I just need to? Right? And we can become so absorbed in that years can go by to the point we don't even know why we're doing it or what was the original purpose. We get so entangled in these things. And then sometimes we wake up to that and we go, I don't know what the hell's going on, but this is not working out. This has got to change. And then we become more aware of opening up the possibilities, situations. The rug gets pulled out from underneath us. Sometimes we pull the rug out from ourselves. Sometimes it gets pulled out. That's a good thing. I really appreciate it when that happens. You know, eventually. Right. And so when we look at trying to bring wisdom and compassion, but I would say even more accurately, trying to bring understanding what's going on as best we can, and then having some compassion or a sense of concern, a willingness to do something that's difficult, that's challenging. Compassion, I feel, is actually more of a behavior than it is anything else. Right? Seeing the pain of somebody else and being willing to do something. Feeling the pain of yourself and being willing to do something. It is, there isn't an emotional sort of attitude associated with compassion, but compassion is more likened to a behavior, a doing of something. And a lot of times I find that it's usually doing of something that's very uncomfortable for me. It's oftentimes a new behavior. And so when we think about, I often like to think about the Buddha as being a person who really struggled with coming to terms with his Dharma and then also continuing to struggle as he attempted to teach it for 45 years. But we were talking about this earlier, me and Andrew were talking about this, what actually it was that inspired the Buddha to teach was compassion. There's a story where he talks about how he awoke up to this Dharma and understanding the limitations of the human experience in a very real way, in a really poignant way, and also understanding the possibilities and being in the middle of that and realizing what effort it would take for people to do that. He thought to himself, if I were to teach this Dharma, it would be tiring and vexing for me. Probably like trying to teach sixth graders trigonometry or something. Very tiring and frustrating. And so his mind was inclined to not teach. But it was taught that out of anukampa, this Pali word anukampa, which means out of compassion for the world, out of a sense of seeing, oh gee, you know, this would probably really help some people. Out of compassion for the world, he decided to teach this Dharma. So there's a lot of care and concern and an understanding of interdependence. And I think what the Buddha really awoke to was his own humanity. Not that he became some godlike figure who never had an unpleasant thought in his mind. This enlightenment term we get stuck with, which kind of sounds or carries with it a sense of like Buddhist heaven. I don't think that's what happened. I think he just really, really woke up to his own humanity and wanted to help other people do the same. And so part of us developing right view is really looking at this first truth, which I don't like that word truth so much, but the Buddha's first articulation, his sort of first suggestion of what to do about this, working with the reality of dukkha, difficulty, is really actually coming to terms with the limitations of the human experience. You know, the pain body, the emotional system that you have no control over, the reality of things like loss, losing things that are important to you, coming into contact with things that are difficult for you, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, people not doing what they said they were going to do. These things are going to happen. No matter how smart or clever or manipulative or whatever, you're not going to outperform that. You're not going to outperform reality. But we try so hard. So hard. I put so much effort. So there's that kind of, okay, like understanding the limitations, the issue at hand, birth, old age, sickness, and death. I was in a very horrible motorcycle accident about 2 years ago, and I almost died. And I spent maybe six or eight weeks in the hospital, in a hospital bed. And I was like, and you know, I had shattered my pelvis, so I couldn't walk for quite a long time. But I was in the hospital for quite a long time, and I couldn't do anything. I sat there all day, and I was like, without my body. The mind can't do anything without the body. I can't even make a sandwich. All by itself, the mind is pretty useless. It needs the tactile, it needs the body. And I was so grateful for all the meta practice that I'd done because I actually sat in the hospital bed for probably 4 to 6 weeks. I didn't suffer much at all, really. And mindfulness of hospital is not a fun practice. And I was in a very, very gnarly hospital in downtown Los Angeles. It's in a county hospital in Los Angeles. It was not the Hilton or the Four Seasons or really a Super 8. It wasn't even a Super 8. And so the more we understand our limitations, our challenges, the struggle at hand, there's a great book by Gil Fronsdale called The Issue at Hand, which I love that title and actually love the book. And Gil Fronsdale's a brilliant teacher. But The Issue at Hand, really understanding that. Very difficult to do, but we need to do that. It's really coming to terms with our humanity. But if we can't do that, what happens is we get caught in sort of misunderstanding that, but really the word I use is denial. We're in denial. In Buddhist context, they usually use this word ignorance. The cause of suffering is ignorance. I don't particularly like that terminology so much because I think it's a little bit too derogatory. You're ignorant person. But really, if you look at ignorance. It's about ignoring something. And when you ignore something, you know it's true, but you kind of pretend like it's not. They call that denial. In my substance abuse counseling career, I've learned about denial management. And one thing that's interesting when you start to learn about denial, you become aware of all the ways in which you are in denial. And we do that. We have to do that to some degree. We can't be thinking about the fact that we're going to die all the time. We can't be living in fear of these types of experiences, but we have to not be in denial about pain, loss, anguish, limitations. Because the more that we're in denial, that's really where the mind starts to develop what we call craving, which is a fairly barbaric term, but craving, clinging, grasping, the mind's incessant and unsuccessful strategy to try to make things other than the way they are, which happens in every other moment pretty much. And I think that's part of our survival. It's just something that the mind does. It's like this, and the mind is constantly, it could be like this, it should be like this. If you did things differently, it would be like this. It's your fault things are like this. It's their fault that things are like this. Trying to blame the difficult circumstances of reality on yourself or somebody else or those people. We all know who those people are. I haven't met any of those people, but I tend to have a very bad attitude about them. And that cuts us off. That actually really kind of cuts off the compassionate, the empathetic, the realization that we all struggle to some degree. And that this is a lot of this suffering that we get caught in is created in our own mind through imagination, through projection, through perception, through not seeing clearly, through our perceptual database, through our histrionic woundedness. This has happened before. This is going to happen again. I know this is going to happen again. It's happened to me before. This projecting onto the future, forecasting. To some degree, we almost have, can in certain areas of our life, have self-fulfilled prophecy kind of thinking around these things. Wake up to that. I don't think that stops. I don't think that stopped for the Buddha. We were talking earlier, me and Andrew, about mindfulness and how he's also a mindfulness teacher and we teach in different contexts, and I find myself always explaining what mindfulness is to people, and I get so tired of it, and sometimes I'm like, I don't even know what the hell it is, actually. We were joking about it. It's kind of like babysitting your mind. I think that's actually the best way to look at it. You have to babysit your mind, because if you don't keep an eye on the baby, it's going to do really, really destructive things. It's put its hands in the socket, knock something off the counter. It's like you have to literally keep an eye on your mind, or it will cause havoc. It's like a entitled American teenager with a credit card. It's not going to end well, man. That teenager needs a chaperone. Right? And I don't think that we can expect that this is going to sort of stop happening. And so that's part of that right view of like, okay, I need to monitor this. I need to be aware of these things. I need to be honest about the difficulties in my life. I need to be honest about some of the ways I might be in denial. What am I in denial about? Am I? I'm sure I am in denial about something right now. I think to some degree, mindfulness, meditation, these words, self-reflection, to some degree is actually really just about self-honesty, about sort of self-transparency. How honest can you be with yourself about what's actually happening right now? Which is an extremely vulnerable thing to do. But so in your best interest. If you don't know what it is, there's very little you can do about it. And so part of mindfulness is to take what's unknown or not known yet and bringing it into conscious awareness, bringing it into allowing it to become an object. I do that a lot. I really need to look at this. This happens a lot and it causes me a lot of trouble. What is that? What is this? How does it work? This radical self-honesty, I think, is so much what the practice is like. And so we want to become aware of our possibilities. So if we become If we understand our liabilities and put aside our denial strategies and our misunderstandings and our misperceptions, we start to do better. And the more we do better, we become aware of the possibilities. How good can we do? What is our human potential? I believe our human potential is far greater than we even could consider. And again, this is why I love the Buddhist tradition so much, is because they're very, very interested in how well human beings can do. Not pathologizing, none of that sort of stuff. We do that in the West. And there's some benefit in that, clearly. But I've been also very inspired and interested in some of the science around some of the work that has been done by Richard Davidson, who's been studying this stuff in laboratory in Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin. Him and Daniel Goleman recently wrote a book called Altered Traits. Fascinating book. Which is using science to say, okay, what are, all right, let's be honest here, folks. What are the actual benefits that you can expect from developing mindfulness practice? One of the things that they discovered that is very appropriate for this particular group of people is that sitting long retreats have tremendous benefits. Even if the retreat is terrible, it's still really good for you. It's like a big bowl of steamed kale with no tamari on it. Not very good, but really good for you. Just eat it. No? So good for you. Actually, the results of sitting like a 3-day, a 5-day, multiple day retreats like this can have benefits for your neural structures and some of your stuff as much as like sitting 30 minutes a day for 6 months to a year. So you're getting like a, you guys are getting a killer upgrade right now. You're getting a huge software download. And I've always thought that, and teachers talk about that. I've always believed that that's true, but it's really interesting in this book that they talk about the benefits of that, this kind of work. And so again, it's so hard to necessarily believe that or trust that, because one of the things that we find over the years of practice, and whether this is your first retreat or you've been sitting for 20 years, or you've been sitting for 20 minutes, it kind of doesn't really matter so much. Time is just some stuff that we made up so that we could all be at the same place at the same time. It's not actually really real. That's a whole other talk, but time isn't real. You probably know that. There's no such thing as time. It's just all impermanence. Is that these little seeds, these altered states that we kind of develop here, do actually become altered traits. And so we, again, when we go from trying to develop really a view that's rooted in some kind of efficacy, again, in the Buddhist tradition, is that there's an intellectual understanding that's being asked, conceptual. And the Buddha is actually asking us to question that too. Don't believe everything I say. The Buddha said the same thing. Don't take my word for it. Don't listen to me. Don't listen to anybody until you have corroborated it for yourself in your own direct subjective, your own epistemological experience. You're like, oh yeah, I totally suffer in ways that are unnecessary. You probably got that. Did you guys get that box checked today? Check. Cool. I do that. Gee. Is there something I can do about that? Well, let's have a look. Let's see if I let that go. I come back. I do this thing. Well, this is better than that. Let's stay with that one. So you're doing a lots of application and retreat practice. You're doing lots of trial and error. You're kind of in your own laboratory. Right? Some of the things I say will make sense, some of them won't. Some of the practice sessions will be beneficial, some of them will not. No big deal. But part of sati, part of mindfulness, part of your own intuitive internal wisdom is just taking the nuggets that are working now and letting everything else, worry about the other stuff later. Don't look for what you don't agree with here. Just look for what seems to be beneficial and cultivate that. And then that becomes sort of when we think about the, I sort of just did a talk on the Four Noble Truths without telling you that. But when we understand the dukkha, the liabilities of our experience, our limitations, we overcome the misunderstandings and the denials and the clinging. We become aware of our possibilities. Once we become aware of the possibilities, and once we become aware of the causes of well-being, not just the causes of suffering, what causes suffering? What causes well-being? Then it's so much easier to act accordingly, isn't it? And once you have that seed or that transmission, or really that, the Pali term is sada, once you have that sada, which means like faith, which is problematic, I think, because we usually associate faith with belief. But faith in a Buddhist context isn't a belief in something, because usually we think about, I have faith in this, and so I believe this. I haven't tried it out, I haven't questioned it, this is just what I believe. That's like the opposite of Buddhist faith. If I have faith in my own direct experience, I have confidence and trust that if I keep doing what I'm doing, I will end up where I need to go. And you know what? That might look differently for everybody in this room, and it probably should. It probably should. So this is kind of the arising of your own sense of wisdom and understanding. Because, like I said yesterday, once you taste the maple syrup, you can't not know what maple syrup tastes like. You can't really forget it. And Dharma is very potent in that way. Once you kind of know something, the Buddha oftentimes talks about it, my faith in the Dharma is unshakable, this unshakable foundation. And like, I am totally confident here. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to have integrity. I'm going to practice. I'm going to continue to watch my mind. And I'm going to know clearly what to do, what direction to head in. And the one thing about right view I think that's so important is that once we have that confidence of knowing the direction to head in, we can almost rest or become at ease and relax in a sense of like, you'll get there. You'll get there. You're actually, to some degree, I would argue, already there once you're in that experience. It's just the continuing to do that. And of course, it's not that we're going anywhere. Where we're actually trying to go is right here. And the quality of our presence, that short moment repeated, becomes continuous. And that happens gradually, slowly over a period of time. And that state, so you develop these meditative states, which can be everything from a perspective on life, a kind of a cognitive state of understanding, an emotional state, a behavioral state. And so when we start to recognize the states that are worthy the joy state, the contented state, then it's much easier to continue to do what it takes to develop and to cultivate those states. And that actually becomes a trait. That becomes a habituation. That just becomes something that you do. You know, can mindfulness, can this ability to remember to recognize the present moment experience, can that start to become a default setting in your mind? That's just where the mind lands. It goes back to that one. Imagine if that was autopilot. Imagine if presence and kindness was autopilot. Can you imagine what it would be like inside your mind? Can you imagine what the world would be like? Because as we all know, at least conceptually, if you change your mind, you change the world. Because you live in your mind. You don't live in the world. There's no world. There's no out there. It's all in here. And the reason I say that, and I completely believe that that's true, is because I used to live in a world of pain and loss and anger and fear and violence. I don't live in that world anymore. I live in a world of understanding and kindness and connection. And I can guarantee you the out there has not changed one iota. It's maybe gotten a little bit worse out there. Mm-hmm. But so through this kind of internal process experience, I just don't live in a world like that anymore. I used to live in a world like that. Very real, very scary. What changed? Did the world change? Did the world become a more kind, understanding, benevolent place in the last 24 years? Not according to Google. No, I've been cultivating different qualities and paying attention and engaging in therapeutic processes and just really trying to improve the quality of my experience. And my quality of experience has improved greatly. And so that makes it much easier to continue. So in some sense, and I'll speak about this because each night I'll speak a little bit about this right view as kind of a theme for this retreat, because I think metta vipassana, the practices that you're doing, are the most effective ways to develop this right view, because it does emphasize ethics and the heart and these brahmaviharas, which we'll speak about, and wisdom and understanding. And to cultivate, to intentionally cultivate a moment of presence and ease. That short moment repeated becomes continuous. You can cultivate that. That can become a default setting of the mind. You can reinforce that neural structure. You can create that view, that perspective on life, on reality. This can't not work. It just can't. And so when we like, my worldview, big picture, complete picture, full gestalt moment, my worldview is largely in connection with how I see this moment. How do I see this one? Because the way I see this moment is actually how I see the world. And if I can train and hearken and continue to allow myself to see the moment with more clarity, with more insight, with more compassion, with more kindness, then if I can do it in this moment, then I can see the world that way. So the sharpening of the razor blade, the sharpening of the knife in every single moment, it's having all these benefits and all these, it's making all these other adjustments that you actually don't have any idea. You just stay with it. It's like the story that I like so much, where they're talking about a chef, and the chef is sharpening his knife. And so if you're a chef and you need to cut vegetables, you need to have a nice sharp knife. So he spends a lot of time sharpening his knife. Now, he's not sharpening the knife to become good at sharpening knives. He's sharpening the knife so he can be good, skilled at cutting vegetables. Right? So you're not here sharpening your mental faculties and sharpening and shaping your heart into a more benevolent way so you can have a little pleasant private moment on retreat, hopefully. No, it's so you can live your life from that place. Don't miss the forest for some of the trees. And so, as you sit through these days and these moments, be very, very careful to just kind of, and I'll talk about this more tomorrow, about watching and monitoring the attitude of the mind in this moment. What is the attitude of the mind in this moment? Because we become so myopic. The moment is like this. It's pain and confusion and I'm hungry and I'm tired. And it's like this. It's always like this. And we get very trapped and that becomes, the world becomes this little tiny thing based on the present conditions that we're in. And so training, learning to see the complete picture. Understanding that this heart of right view is about both. It's about really understanding, being clear, acknowledging our limitations, our possibilities, and having an attitude and a relationship towards that that is benevolent, that is kind and friendly and understanding. So I offer this for your reflection this evening. Thank you for your attention. And let's just sit for a minute or two.